The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from the Week magazine edition dated March 23rd, 2012. We'll begin with the main stories section from the week. It's entitled, More Reason for Economic Optimism. What happened? A third straight month of large employment gains gave renewed hope this week that an economic recovery dogged by false starts might finally be taking root. The economy added 227,000 jobs in February, according to a better-than-expected report from the Labor Department, and growth in December and January was revised upward by a combined 61,000. Jobs. It was the 17th straight month that employment rolls showed increases, and the third month in a row that the economy added more than 200,000 jobs, bringing the total number of private sector jobs added over the past 2 years to 3.9 million. The unemployment rate stayed unchanged at 8.3%, largely because 500,000 workers rejoined the labor force. The only real debate now among economists, said Justin Wolfers at Princeton University, is whether the economy is recovering or recovering strongly. The job gains were spread widely across the economy, including manufacturing, 31,000, healthcare, 61,000, and business services, 82,000. President Obama hailed a surge in hiring, which will boost his chances of re-election if it lasts until November. There are better days ahead, President Obama said. Our job now is to keep this economic engine churning. And now here's what the editorial said. So has America finally turned the corner? Asked the Financial Times. The evidence remains mixed compared with past recoveries when job gains surpassed 400,000 a month. The recent upsurge in hiring is actually quite modest. And let's not forget that last spring, the U.S. economy also enjoyed 3 consecutive months of job gains over 200,000, only to have that hopeful recovery killed in its tracks, partly because of higher oil prices. Another oil shock, a euro debt bombshell, or a conflict with Iran could yet derail this vulnerable economic upturn. Congress's refusal to aid the recovery poses another threat, said the New York Times. The federal highway bill, a prodigious job creator that would put people to work on the nation's crumbling highways, is stalled in the House. Republicans continue to demand deep cuts to federal spending, even though a repeat of last year's budget fights could hobble business and consumer confidence at a particularly sensitive economic moment. The latest employment signs are encouraging, but there's a lot more climbing to do. Now here's what the columnist said. This is no false spring, said James Serwacki in The New Yorker. A prime piece of evidence is that Americans are buying new cars again. Car sales in February were up nearly 16% over last year, which is pushing factories and other businesses to add jobs. When the millions of 20-something Americans who have had to live with their parents for the past few years get jobs and begin to move out, we can expect a spike in demand for not just housing, but all the other stuff that you put in a house. The creation of new households could start a virtuous cycle that really gets the economy humming. Has anyone noticed that something about the U.S. economy isn't adding up? Asked John Hilsenrath in the Wall Street Journal. Even though unemployment has fallen over the past year, the economy itself is barely growing. Many economists now believe that economic growth will be about 2% in the first 3 months of this year, down from 3% in the last quarter of 2011. That's not normal because job growth and GDP usually rise together. And that could mean job growth will slow in coming months, said David Leonhardt in the New York Times. Many economists, in fact, are predicting that as companies see revenues leveling off, hiring for the rest of the year may slow to 140,000 to 180,000 new jobs a month. That's the last thing Obama wants to hear, said Josh Boak in Politico.com. If job creation slows at the height of the presidential campaign and the unemployment rate stays near 8.3%, it will give new life to Republican charges that Obama's policies impeded a natural cyclical recovery. Voters are sick and tired of lean times. With recent job reports creating rising expectations of a full recovery, Obama can't afford a letdown. The next article from the main story section is entitled, A Massacre in Afghanistan. The U.S. war effort in Afghanistan was left in jeopardy this past week after a rogue American soldier left his base in the southern province of Kandahar and shot dead 16 sleeping civilians, including 9 children. Villagers described a terrifying string of attacks in which the staff sergeant went door to door gunning down entire families. The 38-year-old soldier, who suffered a traumatic brain injury in Iraq and is going through a divorce, surrendered and was whisked out of the country despite calls by Afghans to try him in their courts. Afghan President Hamid Karzai described the massacre as inhuman and unforgivable. President Obama apologized, and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta flew to Afghanistan to meet with Karzai. Panetta said the killings would not accelerate plans to withdraw most U.S. forces in or by 2014. The game is over in Afghanistan, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. U.S. counterinsurgency strategy is to protect and provide basic services to Afghans, supplanting their ties to the Taliban. That won't work if ordinary Afghans fear that an American soldier in their midst might murder their family in the night. We should withdraw all our troops now, because whatever gains the war might once have offered are now nowhere in sight. The killings were horrific, but are no reason to rush for the exits, said USA Today in an editorial. This rampage wasn't met with the widespread demonstrations that followed the recent Koran burnings by U.S. troops, which were viewed as an affront to all Afghans. After 2 decades of war, unfortunately, Afghans are all too familiar with indiscriminate killing. Clearly, this soldier cracked, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, giving us grisly proof of how war and can degrade men and nations. But the U.S. can't respond by cracking too. The best option is to stick with Obama's strategy of building a good enough Afghan army and negotiating a power-sharing agreement with the Taliban. Speeding up the pullout would only result in yet more chaos and dead bodies. The next item is entitled Santorum's Southern Surge. Mitt Romney's claim to inevitability took a big blow this past week as his conservative rival, Rick Santorum, won surprise victories in the Alabama and Mississippi primaries. Polls had suggested Santorum would struggle to compete in the South with Romney and Newt Gingrich, but an overwhelmingly evangelical turnout narrowly pushed the socially conservative Catholic over the top. Gingrich finished second in states that his own campaign had described as must wins. He said he would fight on until the GOP convention in August, but will now be under heavy pressure from anti-Romney conservatives to exit the race and give Santorum a chance to take on Romney head-to-head. Romney managed only third place in both states, but because delegates were awarded proportionately, he increased his lead in the overall delegate count. With victories in American Samoa and Hawaii, Romney now has a total of 494 to Santorum's 251. It's become a race of mathematics versus a movement, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. Romney has the most delegates, but with his fiery popularism, Santorum continues to captivate. He captivates the grassroots heart of the party. His strategy now is to deny Romney the 1,144 delegates he needs to capture the nomination and force an open convention. But exit polls show that Santorum still hasn't convinced most Republicans that he can beat Obama. If voters think he's unelectable, his emerging position as the conservative juggernaut means little. He also still has Gingrich in his way, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Conservatives may clamor for his withdrawal, but Gingrich isn't likely to heed the call. He still has funding from grassroots donors, dislikes both Santorum and Romney, and most of all, he really thinks America deserves a Gingrich presidency. Whether Santorum likes it or not, Newt is here to the bitter end. Still, Romney remains the most likely nominee, said Nate Silver in NewYorkTimes.com. These were the sorts of states that Romney was supposed to lose, and he still ended up with the most delegates. But a loss to Santorum in Illinois next week would shift the overall course of the race, increasing the odds of a contested convention. Polls show a virtual tie there between Santorum and Romney, so we should have a real race on our hands. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the main story section of the Week magazine. It's entitled, Invisible Children, Can a Viral Video Help Africa? What has happened in the past week has been momentous, said Matthew Green in the Financial Times. A small, obscure group of activists known as Invisible Children has sparked a global conversation by posting a half-hour video online about Joseph Kony, a Ugandan warlord who for a quarter century has been abducting children and using them as soldiers in his rebel army. Thanks to Invisible Children's strategic use of social media, including convincing celebrities such as Angelina Jolie, Rihanna, Diddy, and Justin Bieber to recommend the video via Twitter and Facebook, more than 110 million people watched Kony 2012 in a week, making it the most rapidly spreading viral clip in the history of the Internet. Critics were quick to charge Invisible Children's slacktivists with simplifying Uganda's complex politics, said Ivor Tossel in the Toronto Globe and Mail. Kony, a suitable villain, is used in the video as a proxy to explain everything that's wrong with Uganda and with Africa as a whole. Still, this burst of energy from our connected youth shows the public policy potential of social media. Please don't be so naive, said Mark Kirsten in Salon.com. Yes, Joseph Kony has committed atrocities, but so has the government he's fighting. Invisible Children's dangerously simple message is that Western nations should intervene to capture Kony. The sad reality is that war has been raging in that region of Africa since 1986, and the incursion of foreign forces has always resulted in more violence, more killings, and more abductions. The self-congratulatory tone of the video, in which young people hitting share buttons are portrayed as the world's best hope, seems to suggest that it is the white man's burden of American hipsters armed with smartphones to save Africans from themselves. Joseph Kony isn't even in Uganda anymore, says James Arinataway in the DailyBeast.com. He fled into the jungle of neighboring countries at least 5 years ago with a few hundred followers. Last year, President Obama sent special operations troops to help coordinate regional efforts by several African governments to find him. With that hunt on, most of Ugandans would rather close this dark chapter of our history and move on. Our most pressing problems in 2012 involve health care, the economy, and education, neither dramatic nor sexy enough to inspire the Facebook generation. To call widespread attention to Africa's many problems, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, groups like Invisible Children have to simplify. Professional foreign policy experts who multiply complexity for a living may think Africa should only be discussed in white papers no one reads. But the pursuit of CONI is urgent, and the online campaign will guarantee that governments keep the pressure up until he's brought to justice. Capturing CONI would send an important signal to other thugs in Africa, said Nikki Wolf in the London Guardian. Meanwhile, anything that shines a light on the atrocities that are an almost daily occurrence in this region is a good thing. The backlash against CONI 2012 is also a good thing, said Rebecca Rosen in the Atlantic.com. The Internet is now buzzing with discussions by informed scholars, activists, and journalists about Ugandan history, African colonialism, and the best way for outsiders to help that continent. The Internet can spread simplistic and even bad ideas, but its beauty is that it's a self-correcting ecosystem. By engaging tens of millions of people, a simplistic video has sparked a debate that may reshape how Americans and others in the West understand the politics and pitfalls of aid and development around the world. Now, from the controversy of the week, we'll turn to a popular column entitled The Good Week For and The Bad Week For. Certainly a much lighter look at the news. It was a good week for concentrating on the next move after the European Chess Union introduced a dress code that bans female players from plunging necklines and major displays of cleavage. It was a good week for Sultan Kozin, the world's tallest man, after University of Virginia doctors were able to halt the Turkish giant's runaway growth at 8 feet 3 inches. The human body and heart is not well designed for a person who is 8 feet tall, his doctor said. And it was a good week for changing with the times, after Encyclopedia Britannica announced that after 244 years, it would no longer make its 32-volume print encyclopedia and instead focus on its digital business. It was a bad week for U.S.-Canadian relations after former Vice President Dick Cheney canceled a speaking engagement in Toronto, citing a major security issue. On Cheney's last visit to Canada, protesters trapped him in a building while police scuffled with the crowd. It was a bad week for learning from your mistakes after Jose Romero Valenzuela of Las Vegas was pulled over by Oregon cops 3 times in 1 hour and charged with driving 105 miles per hour, then 98 miles per hour, and then 92 miles per hour, respectively. You would have hoped the message would have gotten across the first time, said a police spokesman. And it was a bad week for Dan Dolan, a Republican congressional candidate from Iowa, who made a campaign speech to what he thought was the state GOP convention. The Democratic convention actually was using the room at the time. Dolan said that as he spoke, a guy raises his hand and says, "I think you want to talk to the Republicans." And now we'll turn to the People's section for the Week magazine this week. And this first item is entitled Richie's Uncool Credentials. Lionel Richie doesn't care if you think his music is cheesy, said Ed Potten in the London Times. I'm not hip, he says with a shrug. I discovered what hip represents. It means now. If you had the number one record in 1975, in 1978, they didn't know you anymore. So why are his schmaltzy ballads like 1984's Hello still popular? I found the corniest subject that'll never go out of style, says Richie, who is 62, the corniest words on the planet. I love you, I want you, I need you. I don't care whether you're Al Capone or the Wall Street Killer. Sooner or later, you're going to fix your mouth and say, I love you, to somebody. That one-size-fits-all sentiment has made Richie a global superstar. He's famously huge in the Middle East and won him some powerful fans. When Nelson Mandela traveled to the U.S. soon after his release from a South African jail in 1990, he hired Richie as his wardrobe advisor. I got a call from one of Mandela's people saying, we need 10 of these, 5 of these, he says. Afterwards, Mandela came over and said, young man, I want to thank you. Your songs got me through many years of jail. I just cried. I'm crying now just thinking about it. The next item from the People's section is entitled Obama's Transgender Nanny. Once long ago, Evie looked after a boy she called Barry Obama, said Niniak Carmini in the Associated Press. Obama grew up to become the world's most powerful man, but his transgender former nanny now lives in fear on Indonesia's streets. Life was never kind to Evie. Growing up in Jakarta, she was regularly beaten by her father, who wanted his son to act like a boy. She says, even though I didn't feel it in my soul, bullied and teased, she quit school to become a cook, and then, in 1969, was employed by Obama's mother to look after the then 8-year-old Barack. Evie never dressed as a woman around her young charge. He did see me trying on his mother's lipstick sometimes. That used to really crack him up. When Obama's family left Indonesia in 1971, Evie couldn't find another job and turned to prostitution. She stopped dressing as a woman in 1985 after soldiers beat one of her transgender friends to death. I knew I was a woman, but I didn't want to die like that. For Evie, who now barely earns enough money to survive, Obama's 2008 election victory gave her a rare reason to feel proud. Now when people call me scum, I can say I was the nanny for the President of the United States. And our final item in the People's section, Johnston's personal drug war. Kristen Johnston has battled addiction all her life, said Bill Hoffman in the London Daily Mail. The actress started experimenting with drugs and alcohol in high school as a way of coping with a lot of self-loathing. She was soon stealing Vicodin from her mother, who had just had knee replacement surgery, says Johnson, and taking painkillers prescribed for my own sweet dog. Her lowest point came in 2006 when she was in London for a theater production. I was thrilled to discover that you can buy codeine over the counter in London. I discovered that if I took 30 or 40 pills a day, I'd be fine. But years of painkiller abuse had left her innards in tatters. And on the show's second night, an ulcer in her stomach burst open. I was covered in blood and vomit, sobbing like a 4-year-old. Johnston spent months recuperating in a hospital, but was drinking again within a week of her release. That's when I realized it was a compulsion. She entered rehab that same week and finally confronted the hideous monster I had tried to hide. Johnston has now been clean for 5 years. It's not easy, but it's easier than being a drug addict. Now I'd like to read to you the briefing from The Week magazine. This week, the briefing is entitled, The Once and Future President. Vladimir Putin has just been elected to his third term as Russia's president. Do Russians really respect him? Was Putin fairly elected? Not remotely, but that's not to say anyone could have beaten him. Since he first took the helm in Russia in 1999, Vladimir Putin has ruled with a modified form of Soviet-style authoritarianism that he calls managed democracy. The idea is that weaken state institutions, including the electoral system, yield to the designs of a strong leader. That entails some outright fraud. Monitors found evidence of carousel voting in which busloads of voters travel around casting ballots under different names. And in Chechnya, more pro-Putin votes were counted than there were registered voters. But managed democracy relies even more on subtler manipulations. Technical reasons are found to prevent opposition parties from registering. Massive state resources, including almost all TV and radio news, are brought to bear in favor of the Kremlin. Phony opposition candidates are put forward. Those tactics delivered Putin an official victory of almost 64%. That number was surely inflated, but Putin does inspire heartfelt devotion among many Russians. Why do they admire him? Putin represents stability, a welcome contrast to the chaos of the first decade after the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991. Under Boris Yeltsin, a few tycoons known as oligarchs were allowed to plunder state resources in a period of wild privatization that plunged millions into poverty. Putin reversed that process, reasserting firm central control over Russian resources. During his reign, the Russian economy has grown by an average of 7% a year. Poverty has been halved, and the average monthly salary of Russians has more than tripled. High global prices for Russia's vast oil and natural gas resources played a big role in that success. But many Russians give Putin credit for the fact that they are much better off than they ever were before. How did he tame the oligarchs? He opened fraud proceedings that left some, Mikhail Dordakovsky, in jail and drove others like Boris Bezerovsky out of the country. But some oligarchs, notably Roman Abramovich, remain close to Putin. Hedge fund manager William Browder, a former Putin admirer who was banned from Russia in 2005, says Putin moved against the oligarchs mainly to secure their wealth for himself and his cronies. They've now consolidated their position to such an extent that Putin is likely to be one of the richest men in the world, he said last month. By one estimate, Putin is worth $40 billion. Still, Putin's battle against the oligarchs helped establish him as a natsoyasha mushkik, or real man. In a country where the Stalin era is often wistfully recalled as a time of Russian glory, that is an important image. Russia needs a strong leader, a Moscow vendor told the Toronto Globe and Mail. It's such a big country with so many different ethnic groups that it's very difficult to unite. It requires toughness. How does Putin project strength? Through relentless propaganda aimed at promoting a cult of personality. Putin, who is 59 years old, is physically fit. He doesn't drink and was a judo champion in his youth. And he makes sure the Russian public knows it. State television routinely shows him engaged in manly pursuits like racing cars, hunting big game, piloting fighter jets, riding bare-chested on horseback, and zooming around unhelmeted on a Harley-Davidson. During the terrible forest fires of 2010, Putin personally dumped tons of water on the flames from a water bomber. In one of his more ridiculous photo ops just last year, he was shown scuba diving in the Black Sea, where he conveniently discovered two ancient but curiously pristine Greek urns in just 7 feet of water. Do people believe these stunts? Well, they seem to until recently, but the urn find was a tipping point. The international press quickly mocked Putin, and even Russian commentators expressed skepticism, forcing the Kremlin to finally admit that the episode had been staged. Since then, more cracks have appeared in Putin's popularity. Last September, when he announced his intention to take back the presidency, Russians began grumbling openly about the dearth of democracy in managed democracy. They were further offended by what looked like the outright stealing of the December parliamentary elections, which Putin's United Russia Party won, despite trailing badly in exit polls. Tens of thousands of people protested the results, and Putin's approval rating dropped to below 50%, down from 73% as recently as February 2011. Will his rule now be challenged? Yes, but the opposition has yet to prove it has staying power. The series of massive protests since December, particularly of middle-class Muscovites, clearly took the Kremlin by surprise. Anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny, who dubbed United Russia the party of crooks and thieves, has emerged as a grassroots leader and may be able to better galvanize the anti-Putin movement than more traditional opposition figures. But the protests are already petering out. We have to think of something more concrete, something other than protests, said Nikolai Believ, a businessman who quit his job to join the protest movement. I very much want to hope that society is not going to fall asleep again. And the footnote to this article is entitled How Putin Came to Power. Putin owes his ascent directly to the bloody Second War in Chechnya, the separatist Muslim province in the south. He was head of the FSB, the successor to the KGB, when Yeltsin named him prime minister in 1999, saying Putin would solve the Chechnyan problem for good. Putin famously vowed to hunt down separatist leaders even when they're going to the bathroom. Just weeks later, 300 died in a series of Moscow apartment buildings that was blamed on Chechnyans. Russia invaded, Yeltsin resigned, and Putin was elected president to prosecute a brutal war that killed tens of thousands, mostly civilians. Several Russian reporters and whistleblowers have amassed evidence that the FSB staged the apartment bombings to propel Putin to power. At least four of them have been murdered, including Anna Politkovskaya, a reporter gunned down outside her home, and Alexander Litvinenko, an FSB whistleblower poisoned with radioactive polonium. Now we'll take a look at the best columns in the U.S., at least according to The Week magazine for this week, March 23rd, 2012. The first one is entitled Banning Pro Football's Bounty System. It's written by Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Unless it wants to lose America's youth to soccer and volleyball, the National Football League better stamp out bounties for good, said Steve Chapman. The New Orleans Saints allegedly paid its defenseman $1,000 for a hit that took a player off the field and promised up to $10,000 for delivering Brett Favre's head on a platter. I realize football is a violent game and that gentle souls tend to get weeded out in high school. But there is a difference between a hard tackle and aggravated assault. Other sports have cleaned up dangerous and brutal practices. Baseball has banned the beanball, for instance, and even hockey has taken steps to curtail fighting. If NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell doesn't follow suit and banish bounties for violence, he runs the risk of alienating fans and convincing frightened parents to keep their kids off the gridiron. Ending bounties will be easier than banning steroids, suspend guilty players for a season, levy six-figure fines, and strip teams of draft picks, and voila, no one will think $1,000 is worth the risk. The rules of the game already include penalties for unnecessary roughness. It's time to get serious about enforcing them. And this, of course, was written last week in time for the deadline for The Week magazine. There is big news this week about suspension of the coach, the head coach of the New Orleans Saints, as well as the defensive coach and one of the other players who left, has been suspended indefinitely. We'll have more details about that, I am sure, in next week's edition of The Week magazine. Let's look at the next column, GOP Voters Make the Best of a Bad Hand, by Ross Dutat in the New York Times. Republican primary voters deserve a bit more credit, said Ross Dutat. Pundits have been quick to cite this long, shrill, and vacuous primary race as proof that Republican America has gone crazy. But in fact, GOP voters have behaved with admirable restraint. A crazy party would have nominated one of the bomb throwers and ideologues like Michelle Bachmann and Herman Kane. But instead, they were dismissed before the race got going. A crazy party would not have recognized Rick Perry as a flawed candidate. Having rejected those unpalatable choices, the electorate is now gathering around the safe option, Mitt Romney. That choice shows that GOP voters aren't crazy, but simply stuck between generations, between the Bush administration's tarnished office holders and future stars like Chris Christie and Marco Rubio. Republicans have been forced to choose from a roster of retreads, mediocrities, and cable news candidates. Instead of eloping with a right-wing Mr. Wrong, they've sensibly chosen the slow trudge toward the altar with Mr. Good Enough. And the third column is entitled The Deadly Threat from Wind Energy by Robert Bryce in the Wall Street Journal. The wind energy industry has a license to kill, said Robert Bryce. Every year, almost 10,000 birds, including golden eagles, American kestrels, burrowing owls, and other protected species, die after crashing into the wind turbines at California's Altamont Pass. This slaughter violates two of America's oldest wildlife protection laws, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Eagle Protection Act. A pernicious double standard is at work here. Over the past two decades, the federal government has initiated hundreds of cases against oil, gas, and electricity producers for breaking wildlife laws. Yet the Obama administration has never prosecuted a wind farm, and the green movement is guilty of an even bigger hypocrisy. For years, its members have complained that too few Americans were paying attention to the science of climate change. But they've ignored widespread evidence that their most beloved form of clean energy is devastating wild bird populations. To save the environment, it seems, you first have to wreck it. And now we will flip to the back of the magazine, the Week magazine that is, and we'll find the article entitled The Last Word. The specific subject this week is learning from the octopus. The wisdom of our fellow organism, says Rafe Sagarin, can help us fight terrorism, natural disasters, and disease. Fish don't try to turn sharks into vegetarians. Living immersed in a world of constant risk forces the fish to develop multiple ways to live with risk rather than try to eliminate it. The fish can dash away from the shark in a burst of speed, live in places sharks can't reach, use deceptive coloration to hide from the shark, form schools with other fish to confuse the shark. It can even form an alliance with the shark. All of these things may help the fish solve the problem of how to avoid getting eaten by the shark. But none of these adaptations will help the fish solve the general problem of predation, and it doesn't need to. The fish doesn't have to be a perfect predator avoidance machine, like every single one of the countless organisms it shares a planet with. The fish just has to be good enough to survive and reproduce itself. Like the environment of fish and sharks, the world we spend our daily lives in is also full of risks, acts of terrorism, wars, natural disasters fueled by global changes in climate. A distribution of food that leaves billions unnourished and millions of others facing an obesity epidemic. The cyber infrastructure that we increasingly rely upon has also become increasingly vulnerable to catastrophic attack. New diseases and new mutations of old diseases threaten to become global pandemics. The major threats society faces today are ominous and complex interplays of human behavior and environmental change, global politics and local acts of cruelty or carelessness, historical accidents, and long simmering tensions. Some of these threats have plagued us as long as we have been human, and yet we still made little progress against them. Others are becoming more dangerous in synergy with rapid climactic and political changes, and still others are now just emerging. Yet the responses we have been offered or forced to accept by the experts we've trusted to solve these problems often seem frustratingly ineffective, naive, or just plain ridiculous. When increased body screening of airline passengers was implemented after 9/11, Richard Reed attempted to destroy an airliner with a bomb in his shoe. And when shoes began to be screened in response to Reed's attack, Al-Qaeda plotted to use a liquid explosive attack. And when liquids were banned, Umar Farouk Abdulmuladab used a powered incendiary hidden in his underwear in an attempted attack. Far from any airport on a tiny island in the tiny town of Beaufort, North Carolina, there is a tiny outpost of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, it's frequently called. Although I lack high-level security clearances, I'm fairly certain this little laboratory, which studies fish and coastal ecology, is not on any terrorist group's list of targets. Yet when the NOAA coastal scientists wanted to renovate and add some space a few years back, they were forced by the Department of Homeland Security to install enormous Walmart-style parking lot lights on their facility as a required security measure. This was ironic since the scientists working at the lab know full well that nighttime light pollution is a major threat to the same coastal marine environments that they are paid by taxpayers to study. Life on Earth has a lot to show us about how to create more adaptable systems than these, but with the doors to this vast pool of expertise on adaptability blown open, a daunting new question emerges. Where to begin? In nature, there are wings and eyes and claws and stingers and killer viruses and helpful bacteria. 13-year-long naps and a 5,000-foot deep-sea dive, suits of armor and solar energy factories, stolen poisons and secret coded messages, all working in some way to aid the adaptability and security of their owners. So where would be a good place to start discovering which of these things would be useful to help solve our own security problems? If you want to learn about security and adaptability from nature, I can think of no better place to start than to stare into the eye of an octopus. Octopuses learn not only how to survive, but how to thrive in almost any environment. Even in the barren, isolated tanks of a marine biology lab, colleagues have discovered octopuses escaping from their chambers and braving the dry air to scamper across a lab bench and find a snack in a nearby tank before returning to their own. But this portrayal reveals only part of the octopus's success. With its soft, meaty body, the octopus is an attractive target for predators. So, it constructs a protective den in the rocks, sometimes with a peephole for its keen eyes to peer out from. If good rocky crevices aren't available, it will learn to use whatever is around, a shell, an old crate, or the champagne bottle tossed decades ago from my advisor's shipboard wedding just offshore from the Hopkins Marine Laboratory in Pacific Grove, California. An amusing video making the rounds on the internet shows octopuses in Indonesia that have learned to forage the increased numbers of coconut shells discarded from tourist boats and pull together two halves to make a spherical suit of armor. When the octopus does venture out from its constructed bunker, millions of cells on the surface of its skin are all sensing and responding to the world around, instantly changing shape and color to perfectly match its immediate surroundings. Once after staring at a tide pool in Baja California for a long time, I thought I spied an octopus, but the small waves cresting the tide pool walls riffled the surface too much to be sure. My eyes failing me, I reached my hand in to engage my tactile senses, and instantly a dark cloud of smoky ink filled the pool. By the time it cleared, I had confirmed my identification, but the beast was long gone. John Steinbeck's good friend, the marine biologist Edward F. Ricketts, who is fictionally portrayed as the character Doc in Cannery Row and the other Steinbeck novels, in his Guide to Marine Animals of the Pacific Coast, said this is of the octopus's capacity to blend in and hide. A little observation will convince one that in a given area, probably half of the specimens escape notice despite the most careful searching, a highly desirable situation from the points of view of the conservationist and the octopus. He added, the octopus has an ink sac opening near the anus from which it can discharge a dense sepia-colored fluid, creating a smoke screen that should be the envy of the Navy. And if those defenses don't work, the octopus has a powerful jaw and a mean bite, as the ever-curious Ricketts related in his field notes from a collecting trip in Canada. Another big octopus, I've often wondered if octopi ever bite. Today, I found out. Yes, they do. They certainly do. The blue-ringed octopus takes this biting to extremes. When threatened, it flashes dozens of brilliant blue rings across its body, a warning to predators that it is armed. In this case, with highly toxic bacteria, powerful enough to kill a human that lives symbiotically in the octopus's salivary glands. But blending into the background, disappearing in a flash, and biting usually are not ways to find a mate, and mating is as essential to survival as avoiding predators. For that, an opposite tack is needed, one that sets an individual apart from all others. Some octopuses, when spying a potential reproductive partner, will split their missions. Half of their body facing the mate will pulse with a psychedelic display of color, but the half facing the rest of the world, including other competing male octopuses, is dull and inconspicuous, as if to say, nothing special going on here. Taken together, the octopus reveals almost all of the characteristics you would want in a biologically inspired adaptable security system. Its use of tools, the coconut shells, for example, and its well-known ability to wreak havoc on laboratory containment systems show that it can learn from a changing environment. The rapidly changing skin cells show it has an adaptable organization in which a lot of power to detect and directly respond to changes in the environment is given to multiple agents and that don't have to do a lot of reporting and order taking from a central brain. That it has an ink cloud and camouflage and a powerful bite that it uses for both offense and defense reveals its redundant and multifunctioning security measures. Its ability to deliberately stalk, surprise, and even kill prey much larger than itself shows that it can manipulate uncertainty for its own ends. Finally, its use of deadly bacteria in its own defense reveals that it uses symbiotic relationships to extend its own adaptive capabilities. Not all organisms in nature display these characteristics so prominently as the octopus, but all organisms use them to varying extents to survive and adapt. Despite the massive variation in nature's security systems, all of their solutions follow from one very straightforward concept, adaptability. Adaptation arises from leaving or being forced from one's comfort zone. Accordingly, it's understandable that we might be a little resistant to dive into this strange world where reacting to the previous crisis is no longer good enough and making vague predictions of the future no longer counts as doing something. It's natural that we'd come up with all sorts of excuses for why we can't be more adaptable. But one of the results of using nature with its relentless ability to solve problems and neutralize the unpredictable threats as a template for adaptability is that it weakens almost every excuse we have for not becoming more adaptable. The overwhelming success of adaptation in nature practically shames us into at least trying, and everything that seems like a barrier to change has already been crossed in nature. We complain that our bureaucracies are too institutionalized to change, but even organisms whose outer appearance has remained steadfastly unchanged for millions of years can be highly adaptable by farming out that adaptable capacity to semi-independent parts like immune cells and skin color pigment cells. We argue that there are people we just can't work with or who will never come to peace with one another. But in nature, the meekest organisms form beneficial, symbiotic relationships with the most terrifying. We argue that we can't have guns and butter, but every successful living thing already knows how to balance a way to defend itself, a way to nourish itself, and a way to reproduce itself. Perhaps the last remaining excuse is that we are just different altogether from every other living thing. At a mechanical, biochemical level, this can't be true. Under our hoods is the same DNA engine that powers most life forms. We may have neat flame decals and a clever dashboard GPS system, but we're essentially the same type of vehicle weaving through traffic and occasionally driving right over it on the road to life. That was adapted from Learning from the Octopus, copyrighted 2012 by Rafe Sagarin, reprinted by permission from Basic Books. And now we'll turn to the Talking Points section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled Pink Slime, the mystery in our meat. McDonald's Bandit, said Nick Carbone in Time.com, and the British government says it's unfit for human consumption, yet it could be in your fridge or your kid's school lunch right now. We're talking about pink slime, a gelatin-like, ammonia-treated mix of low-grade beef scraps and connective tissues used as filler in some 70% of all supermarket ground beef. Several fast food chains swore off the stuff earlier this year under pressure from celebrity chef James Oliver. But last week, the Daily revealed that the U.S. Department of Agriculture was buying 7 million pounds of it for school lunches this year. Shockingly, consumers have no way of knowing whether cow parts, once useful only for dog food and cooking oil, are in their burgers, said K.J. Del Antonia in the NewYorkTimes.com. The processed material isn't listed as an ingredient, and no wonder. Who would buy a product labeled ground beef with added connective tissues, fatty trimmings, and ammonia? Pink slime may sound gross, but there's really nothing to fear, said Joe Schwartz in the Montreal Gazette. The industry calls the product lean, finely textured beef trimmings, and the ammonia it contains is merely a harmless way to kill off salmonella and E. coli pathogens. Given our current obsession with recycling, we should embrace any process that converts these scraps into edible lean beef. Basically, more meat is produced from fewer cows, and anything that helps bring down food costs is good news, said Alexandra Petri in WashingtonPost.com. Current regulations allow material gained by this process to make up 15% of hamburger meat. Incorporate the treated meat and you shave 3 cents off the cost of making a pound of ground beef. If the slime is safe and makes more food available more cheaply to more people, I'm not inclined to stand in its way. But deeming an ingredient safe doesn't give the government the right to sneak it into our food, said Nancy Hugranoff in HuffingtonPost.com. Federal agencies have a history of allowing questionable ingredients into the food supply. I suspect they did so this time, mainly because this cheap filler actually helps the meat industry increase its profit margin. Enough of that. The pink slime uproar shows that Americans are finally fed up with unsavory ingredients. Just tell us what's in our food. We'll decide whether we want to eat it. The next item, nuclear power, a dying industry. It was supposed to be the energy source of the future, said John Schoen in MSNBC.com, but nuclear power now looks as if it will be relegated to the past. The triple meltdown in Fukushima, Japan, a year ago this week may prove to be the final nail in the U.S. nuclear industry's coffin. As recently as 2005, Congress spoke of a nuclear renaissance, cutting red tape and offering loan guarantees to contractors wanting to build reactors. But the weak economy slowed the demand for energy, while natural gas became a viable, cheap alternative fuel. The disaster in Japan has only weakened the desire to build new reactors. Just four are currently proposed or under construction in the U.S. Actually, that's a relief, said Gwen Dubois in the Baltimore Sun. The 104 nuclear power plants in the U.S. are no better designed than those in Japan, and a serious natural disaster could cause a similar catastrophe here. Fukushima should be a wake-up call to end our nuclear ambitions for good. That would be too hasty, said William Tucker in the Wall Street Journal. Our new generation of power stations is designed to protect against any risk of Fukushima-style meltdown, and there's no evidence to suggest that the low levels of radiation that typically linger after such an event are even harmful, let alone fatal. No one has yet died as a result of the Fukushima meltdown, and many people thrive in areas with radiation levels much higher than are present in the evacuation zone. The real danger comes from not using nuclear power at all, said Brian Walsh in Time.com. It is the only power source that provides constant carbon-free energy. Take nuclear out of the picture, and averting dangerous climate change, already an enormous challenge, becomes much more difficult. Now a couple of short items here as we reach the end of our program for this week. Osama bin Laden spent his final few months stuck in his hideout in Abbottabad with three feuding wives, eight children, five grandchildren, and 10 board assistants, according to a former Pakistani army officer. Bin Laden's oldest wife, Kara Saber, moved in just months before his death, and when his other wives warned him that she might betray him, a resigned bin Laden reportedly said, "If this is what she's going to do, so be it." From the Poll Watch this week, 65% of Americans say it's likely that President Obama will be reelected in November. Democrats are the most confident in their candidate, with 87% saying Obama will likely win. 63% of independents and 42% of Republicans also say it's likely that Obama will win. And 60% of Americans say the war in Afghanistan has not been worth fighting. 54% say the U.S. should withdraw military forces before meeting its current goal of training the Afghan military to be self-sufficient. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to join me again this week. This time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.